All right, please be seated. Good morning. We have the case this morning, State versus Junior L. Williams Homes. It's 21 AP 809 CR. The court is here. Justice Rebecca Bradley is appearing by phone. So I would ask that we kind of listen up in case we hear that she might be wanting to ask a question. It's more difficult to tell when they're on the phone versus here and present. And I'm sure my colleagues, because we've done this a number of times, will listen for that as well. Could I please have your appearances? All right, good morning. I have 25 minutes, followed by 35 minutes in rebuttal. All right? Okay, let's proceed. Let me just ask, Justice Rebecca Bradley, you are on the phone, right?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Chief.
Okay, thanks.
Good morning, and may it please the court. This case centers on a condition of supervision imposed by the circuit court, where that circuit court is attempting to retain a degree of jurisdiction over the defendant to make ongoing routine decisions about the defendant's supervision. And the court did so in this case based out of its mistrust of the Department of Corrections to carry out its statutory obligations to oversee and administer the condition of supervision that's been imposed. In doing so, the circuit court has stepped outside of its proper statutory role and has invaded what is supposed to be the exclusive province of the Department of Corrections and the executive branch.
Attorney Haskell, do you agree that the court could have said you can't live with women or children? As long as it didn't have that second part, unless the court gives you permission.
As a matter of administration and this statutory separation of powers, yes, I think that a court could. I think that the problem in this case goes beyond the court, or it comes from the court stating that it wanted to be, that it wanted the defendant to return to court for permission, that the Court of Appeals has observed, and the state has conceded before this court, that at least the informal version of that permission the circuit court had seemed to envision would be the impermissible administration of the supervision terms. And I think the problem is that even allowing the court to make those alterations through modification runs into the same problems, because the court has still at the outset indicated it wants to exercise an authority to grant or deny permission as to these particular individuals. And so this proposed amendment that I think has been adopted by the Court of Appeals and that's proposed by the state of Wisconsin doesn't solve the statutory separation of powers
problem. But 973093A allows a court to modify the terms and conditions of probation for cause and by an order any time prior to the expiration of probation period. So I don't understand your argument vis-a-vis that statute. Is your argument that I'm not sure what it, I just don't understand why you don't think a court has the right to say, hey, here are the conditions, because you're not disagreeing with the condition as I understand it, correct?
Not at this stage, correct.
Okay, for the purposes of today, whatever. For the purposes of today, you're not contesting that. But what you're saying is that once the court says that you have to come before me in order to get this modified, that is where it is stepping over the line and is administering probation. And I'm reading 973093A as the court has the authority to do just the thing you're saying it can't do. So I don't think I haven't quite digested your argument all the way.
Sure. I think that the problem is the court's expression of intent at sentencing, that this condition was not going to be permanent, that there was seemingly an expectation that during the 5 years the defendant was going to be on supervision, he may return to court, that there may be some modification. The court was not concluding that during this entire term of 5 years, I don't want you living with any women or children, and making that, sort of absolute determination. As a matter of administration in this statutory separation of powers you know, I acknowledge in answer to, you know, Justice Dallet's question, I think that's probably okay. But it's that the judge is expressly expecting that at some point during 5 years, the defendant may be rehabilitated in a certain way, or there may be some condition that changes that allows
him... Isn't that what you want? Isn't that what we all want?
It
right?
is.
And I just have a feeling that had he not qualified the condition with, right now this is what I'm ordering, but you can come in, and as long as you have my permission, we can change these, that you might be in here arguing what I asked you in the onset, which is whether or not you think that the condition that he not reside with any person in any place in which children reside unless you are related to them by blood, or he's also not allowed to reside with any person of the opposite sex, that you would be in here saying that was an unlawful order. So,
sure. I'm not trying to speculate that there's going to be like a slippery slope down which circuit courts begin to impose overly rigid conditions then where they don't invite the permission. I mean, I think the more appropriate balance envisioned by the statutes is that the court would impose a condition expecting or maybe hoping for rehabilitation, and then allowing the agent to exercise its discretion to make those more routine decisions. I mean, the defendant in this case, in addition to an extended supervision revocation he was serving, you know, was going to serve 2 years in prison. And so by the time he was even out of custody, he'd been that much further removed from the sentencing proceedings. So any sort of in-custody rehabilitation that had occurred, I guess...
Well, when does 973.093a apply then? Not in custody. So when would it apply?
The ability to modify?
The ability to modify the terms and conditions of probation. When would it apply?
It applies at any time under State versus Gray, be it before probation. And so the court can do that. But I think the idea is that the statutes have recognized the greater flexibility that an agent can operate with versus a circuit court judge who's been further removed from the case.
I'm asking you to give me an example.
I was just going to say, so if the court would have said you can't live with any women or children unless otherwise modified by the court, would you be here making the same argument?
Yes. I think that the problem there is still an expectation that the condition will be modified versus the more permanent conditions that may be imposed. I mean, I think in an OWI context, there's nothing unexpected about the court ordering no alcohol during the entire term. And there's no expectation that anybody's going to be trying to modify it. The judge doesn't need to make any qualifier about, you know, you need to seek court permission or anything like that. It's similar with, you know, certain no-contact orders that may be ordered at sentencing, that there's nothing contemplated about modifying it. But it's the court's additional statements at sentencing here, again, expressly expecting that the defendant may be allowed to live with women and children, is what takes it outside of the proper imposition of a condition of supervision and brings us into something looking much more like administration, which is supposed to be the role of the Department of Corrections in these cases.
I have to tell you, I feel like essentially what the court said was what I just said. You know, you can't do this unless I modify it. Isn't that within, as Justice Karofsky was saying, 973.093a?
I don't think that that statute can be used by circuit courts to, again, make these sort of routine decisions about how a defendant lives, where the defendant lives, that has been an authority that has been delegated to the Department of Corrections to administer, to oversee the execution of, the use of, and is outside the bounds of simply the imposition of the condition. Again, distinguishing it from, right, a broader condition.
Boy, I see this as a be careful what you wish for kind of argument, because you're hoping that judges are more strict, severe, and unrelenting on what they say, because there will be no flexibility once that condition is imposed.
Well, again, ideally...
And the department can't, if it's you can't live with women or children, the department can't say, oh, yes, you can.
Correct. They would not be able to modify the court's condition. But I think, you know, as I expressed to Justice Karofsky, I'm not too worried about us heading down some sort of slippery slope where judges are imposing overly rigid conditions that even it doesn't necessarily believe are appropriate. I mean, I would hope that courts in the process of sentencing
probably appropriate at the time. The hope, though, as she said, is that you progress through probation, do better, and then eventually are released without having the imposed and stayed or not imposed sentence come to bear.
Right. I mean, again, ideally there is rehabilitation that's occurring, but it's that the agent is in the better position, I think, on those more routine decisions to actually observe the rehabilitation that's occurring, to figure out when it is more appropriate for a defendant to live with somebody else, to change employment. I mean, this is within the standard conditions of extended supervision and probation that the Department of Corrections puts out, is that you obtain agent permission before changing residence or employment.
I'm still having a really hard time seeing where you're drawing the line. So you're saying a judge can, in an OWI case, say you may not have any alcohol, but if the defendant has been sober for some number of years and wants to have a drink, they could make a motion under the statute. But if a judge wants to make a condition, I think I've heard you say a couple of times now, regarding employment or where someone is residing, and the judge wants to review those conditions after some period of time, that is not proper under the statute. I mean, I cannot figure out where you're drawing the line, but so far that's what I'm hearing you say, that OWI, no drinks are here, and where you're living and working is over here?
I don't mean to express that there is something different about an OWI and no alcohol. It's the more absolute condition, the condition that you live with no women or children in this case, or you consume no alcohol, being the proper allocation of statutory authority. If the judge concluded that during Mr. Williams Holmes's 5-year term of supervision, it seemed simply too risky that at any point he'd ever be allowed to live with a woman or child, I think probably, again, as a matter of administration anyway, the court could probably do that.
Let me ask it this way. What is it that you want us to say in this case? What is our holding? What do you want our holding to be here?
That this condition be altered to reflect what I think is the circuit court's intent, that there be some intermediary between the defendant and simply living with women and children, but that the intermediary needs to be the Department of Corrections, that the Department of Corrections is the proper authority to make, again, these routine decisions about who a defendant lives with, where a defendant works, and that the court's comments at sentencing reflecting its willingness to modify the condition show that the court was trying to, I think, keep its fingers in the condition more than is appropriate, and that in properly administering the condition, or that the court is then improperly administering the condition, where it should be the Department of Corrections making the... I think that this is reflected in...
Well, so that's pretty specific to this provision, but when we write a case, it's going to be broader than this one provision in this one case. So what would that rule be, I think, is what Justice Kroski was asking you.
It's the forward-looking nature of the condition, that the court cannot properly impose a condition of extended supervision anticipating its modification.
Okay, so when a court anticipates modification of, give me the rule, when a court anticipates modification of probation
of its
conditions, it must defer to DOC.
Essentially, yeah.
That seems awfully broad. Excuse me. As a circuit court judge, I could see imposing a condition. But push back. I might be wrong in this. But as a circuit judge, I could see imposing a condition, but with the realization that maybe in a year from now, maybe when the defendant... is on his medication, and talking about a different, you know, hypothetical case, on his medication and things are regulated, maybe when someone moves out of state, etc. So I may, as a circuit court judge, impose a condition that I'm very mindful might have to be changed. And it seems like your broad rule is a bit too broad to me. Respond, please.
Yeah, I recognize that The circuit court judge in your hypothetical is being very courteous and mindful of the possibility of rehabilitation and the need for some degree of flexibility in the conditions that it's imposing at the time of sentencing. But I guess where I do want to push back is the notion that I think that that's the role of the agent. Once we've determined, you know, the court has imposed the conditions that it believes appropriate for the term of supervision, it should impose those. But when there is some expectation that the condition is, in fact, harsher than is going to be necessary for the term of supervision, that the agent should be making those more routine calls about who the defendant, again, can live with, work with, be present with.
Is it more that you are asking this court to be clearer than is already out there, because we obviously have some disagreement in the past in other cases, but to be clearer about what it means to administer, which is an executive role, which is the role of probation and parole, versus what it is to set conditions, and that administration belongs with probation and parole, whereas setting forth conditions, modifying them through process set forth in the statute of coming into court, that's the court's role. Isn't it making that distinction clearer?
Correct. I do think that it is important that that distinction be made clearly, but I acknowledge that it is a little strange. I do see how the court's ability to modify a condition and the Department of Corrections' authority to administer a condition, you know, sort of butt up against each other. I mean, in the words of, like, State v. Horn, I mean, it's a shared power statutorily to some extent. But that, right, there should be some clarification about the line where that resides. And my concern is that this case in particular crosses that line, given in particular the circuit court judge's comments that the defendant may not need to be prohibited from living with women and children during the 5 years that he's on supervision.
So then when you have, if we create the rule that you urge us to, if the probation agent says no, there's no recourse by going back to court and asking the judge to say yes. I mean, it works both ways. If the power lies within the agent, that's it. I've actually had those cases where the defendant wants a little more lenity than the agent is willing to afford, and they want to go back to the trial court and say, this isn't what you meant, and they won't let me do this. I would like to do that. I mean, maybe that was completely wrong, right?
No, I don't think that it is. That's where I acknowledge that the modification authority plays a slightly different role when the court is acting essentially in the role of mediator or, you know, dispute resolution between defendant and agent. I think that State versus King discusses that a little bit from the Court of Appeals, that in that case, the defendant being barred from having accounts on certain websites without his agent's permission. And the court envisions that there may be conflicts that exist between the defendant and his agent, and then they can return to court. That was, I think, an ex rel of Lins that is discussed in the briefing as well, where, you know, when there is a conflict between the defendant and the agent concerning the conditions that are being imposed, that there's a dispute resolution role that the court needs to play.
So where's the statutory authority for that? When the defendant wants it, then it can come back to court. But otherwise, it's the agent who has to administer it. What's your best statutory authority for those two propositions?
It flows largely from the court's interpretation of the modification statute 973.093a, particularly in Lins, I believe it's on page 725, with the court expressly acknowledging that there is a dispute resolution component that the modification process can play when the agent is perhaps trying to impose a condition that the defendant finds problematic, and that in that instance, the court is no longer acting as administrator of supervision, is not administering the condition, but is resolving a legitimate dispute that seemingly exists between agent and defendant, and so is operating in a different world that doesn't pose the same problems.
Mr. Haskell, if we disagree with the point you're making about the judge shouldn't be able to impose this process or have this process. Say we decide in the end, you know, the judge, it is permissible for a judge to impose conditions of probation and say, You can't change these without permission of the court. Do you want to weigh in at all on the what we've been calling in this case the informal and the formal process for modifying those conditions of probation? Do you understand the question I'm asking you?
Not entirely. I mean, I guess I hope I've been clear that whether the modification is achieved through the informal process or the formal process, in this particular case, based on the circuit court's comments at sentencing, it constitutes the inappropriate administration.
Right,
supervision.
And I'm trying to put you in the corner a little bit. And I'm trying to ask you, if you had to choose between the formal and the informal, do you have a preference? And is there any argument you want to make to us on those two options?
If the court were to affirm, which version it should affirm?
Correct.
Do you mean?
Yes.
I think that, I suppose being forced to pick how I lose, I suppose it would be more.
I just wanted to give you the opportunity to weigh in on either of those, should you want to do so. Maybe, perhaps you don't. I didn't know if you wanted to. I was straight up. I said I was putting you in a bit of a corner.
If I'm being offered a way out, I'll take it. I do think that, as stated, both are problematic. I understand that the informal process seems probably even more problematic, and acknowledge again that the Court of Appeals has already found that to be problematic. The state, I think, has agreed that that version of this means that the court is no longer exercising its modification authority and is instead only engaging in the administration of supervision, seemingly.
Counsel, problematic is a word I use sometimes. I've been talking this morning about squishy words that I use, and problematic. It couldn't be something absolutely outrageous. And I say, well, this is problematic. Well, the court said something, the Court of Appeals said, this wasn't problematic. The Court of Appeals said in paragraph 17 that this condition, if it is effectuated through the informal oversight regulation supervision procedure that the court appears to have utilized in at least the prior example it referenced in its post-conviction memorandum, this would be unlawful, not problematic, unlawful, as it would amount to the court usurping the department's statutory authority to administer supervision, extended supervision, citing 301.033. Do you think it is more than just problematic? Do you agree with the Court of Appeals in paragraph 17?
I do.
What do you disagree with at the Court of Appeals, putting aside the remedy in this particular case, which I have some questions about, but the Court of Appeals lays out, a relatively clear line, it seems to me. Court of Appeals says, you trial court, you can impose a condition, but you can't administer it. So to the extent the trial court here was trying to administer it by saying, come back to me, shoot me some emails, we'll figure it out, that's problematic. But if you want to come petition the court through the statutory process, the statute allows that, and you can do that. So that seems to me to be a pretty clear line. Do you disagree with that line? If so, I'd like to hear where you disagree with that line. Again, I want to put aside its application to this case and the trial court's order. I just am interested in sort of that legal distinction and the legal analysis that the Court of Appeals did.
Sure. I don't think that there is any particular line between the two. I mean, I know I've sort of said the same thing that, my concern is the court's comments, again, expecting that there was going to be some modification during the period, stating that you needed to come to court to get permission, is where I see the court is overstepping versus simply ordering no living with women or children. The informal nature of this was not admittedly fully known in the record until the post-conviction proceedings when the court it did intend for permission to take the form of these informal communications between an agent and the judge.
What do you mean you don't see it as a line? I misread it, or I'm reading it differently than you, but it seemed to me to be a pretty clear line. There's a statutory process to modify, a term that's been imposed. The Court of Appeals says you can do that, but you can't. Administer it when once you've imposed it. Once you've imposed it, you're done, unless you have a further order of the court. That seems to me to be a pretty clear line, but maybe it's not as clear as I think it is.
I think that it would be, again, in these hypothetical situations where the court says no living with women or children and sort of stops there. But what continues on from the court is the suggestion that there be permission, that the court, you know, is contemplating even allowing contact with the victim in the case, and that it seems to believe that there's going to be some change, that it is imposing a condition, thinking the defendant is going to be back, needs to modify.
Yeah, so maybe, but that might be a separate question. That's the remedy portion. That's maybe a slightly different issue, which is what did the trial court do here? Did the trial court do one or the other? But just the law side for just a second. If you read the order, well, I will talk about the order here for just a minute. If you read, let's say, if the trial court did say you can't live with any other women or children. Absent order from the court, and by that he was clear, absent a statutory modification process. Would you have a problem with that?
He said yes earlier, I think.
Right. I still think it's a problem if the court is suggesting that it is going to be using the modification process to do this at the outset.
Okay.
As opposed to stating, I think that for this 5-year term or for however long the term is in another case, you know, you follow this particular condition.
But that's just... this is not how probation works. I mean, any of the trial judges up here with me are going to tell you that when you're imposing conditions of probation, the hope is, right, that we are going to help people rehabilitate.
Right.
And so I don't know. I just feel like what you're saying is, as long as you just ignore the fact that this could be modified, everything will be okay. And every condition of probation that you set, judges, you need to, whatever the period of probation is, that's how long that condition must be. I guess your light's out, and I'm not really asking a question. But
are you asking a question that you would like an answer to?
Maybe you can reply to that when you...
A sentence or
thank
two?
Thank you.
Sure.
It is only that the Thanks, condition Steve. In that circumstance should not say with permission of the court, but with permission of the agent is all, where the court hopes for that sort of rehabilitation is what I think is more proper and honors what the court is trying to do here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the Court. For decades, this Court has recognized the power of circuit courts to effectuate the goals of probation, not just at the initial sentencing hearing, but even after sentencing, by way of the statutory authority to modify existing supervision conditions. I'm here today to ask that the Court do two things. Above all, first and foremost, to stay true to that holding and reaffirm that the circuit courts can exercise this authority without fear of intruding upon the Department of Corrections or DOC's authority to administer supervision.
It can exercise this authority. This authority you're talking about is modification? Is
that yes.
What you
yes.
mean by, well, isn't, is, I know you have a second point, but.
Second.
I mean, just, isn't that pablum? Okay, the court can exercise authority to modify. Isn't the devil in the details? You're asking us to reaffirm nothing more than that's already set forth in the statute.
I mean, certainly that was our position in the Court of Appeals, that this is basically just an operation of the execution of that statute. The fact that we're here now today, I believe that given the fact that the court has granted review, that it's important to stress that a court can exercise that authority without being accused of violating the Department of Corrections' authority to administer probation.
Well, let's just see if there are any devils in those details. Go on to your
Absolutely.
Next.
Second, I'd ask that you affirm the Court of Appeals' decision because it correctly recognizes that conditions like that, which Mr. Williams Holmes is opposing here, are lawful as long as they are effectuated by the applicable statutory mechanism.
Counsel, I want to talk about that. So the Court of Appeals analysis, I want to set aside for a moment. Let's assume that the Court of Appeals' basic statutory analysis is correct. I found it a little curious in terms of the remedy here in this particular case and want to give you an opportunity to comment on it. When I read what the trial court did, including its post-conviction motion, does seem, at least there's a good argument, that the trial court understood that it wanted to do exactly what the Court of Appeals said it can't do, which is, you know, come back to me on an informal or other basis, and maybe I'll you know, give permission for you to live with individuals. So the Court of Appeals either reads it differently or potentially rewrites it to say what it didn't say. And so even if the Court of Appeals analysis was correct, I would like to hear your response to the argument why at least a remand to the trial court to either clarify what it was doing or to impose a lawful condition consistent with that analysis isn't the more appropriate.
Your Honor, I recognize that certainly this court could remand for exactly that. The position that the state took as far as, you know, kind of opposing remand here is that really it likely doesn't serve much of a purpose given the fact that the court had issued this requirement that he, you know, seek modification of this, and it's tough to see how the court would abandon that. But certainly if this court thinks that it's important for the circuit court to reevaluate and ensure that how the Court of Appeals and this court have interpreted the instruction is how the court intended it, I understand why the court may be inclined to do that.
Well, do you think that the trial court did in fact order you may not live with any children absent a statutory modification order?
It's tough to say whether the circuit court actually envisioned that. I will concede that. I recognize that based on the court's comments at sentencing and the actual restriction as it's written on the conditions of extended supervision form as well as the post-conviction order, they're not entirely clear, and I will concede that. I do think that it is telling when, at the sentencing hearing, when there's a request for a no contact and the court effectively chimes in and says that I've effectively ordered that no contact, it seems like the court had envisioned a blanket prohibition. Whether it envisioned the specific statutory mechanism and knew what the specific statutes were, I can't say that. Ultimately, I understand that the court may be interested in remanding just for the sake of the circuit court evaluating that and making sure that that's how it was meant to be understood.
And this is something that neither of you discussed necessarily. Well, I think opposing counsel did a bit, but it just seems to me that even if the Court of Appeals legal analysis was correct, that the remedy question, like I'm not sure what our authority is to rewrite a term of condition that that may have been aimed at something different than was actually there.
I agree, and I don't think that it's how I construe the Court of Appeals decision is not a rewrite per se. I know that the parties disagree about that. The Circuit Court certainly they provided an example of maybe how this has been done in the past. But there wasn't a specific decision as to, you know, it needs to be done this particular way versus this particular way. So, again, it may be done, or maybe it was envisioned to only be done by email, for example, which I'm not here to defend that practice. If it's done how the Court of Appeals envisioned it, I certainly think that that's a perfectly lawful condition of supervision, though.
I just want to make sure I understand where you're coming from. What I'm hearing you say is that, we're using this formal and informal process, and I think we're all using it and understand what we're talking about here. You do not disagree, that is, you agree with the Court of Appeals, that the informal process is not proper, and that in order to modify the conditions of probation, you need to go the formal, that is, the statutory process, that conditions of probation can be modified for cause and by order of the court at a hearing, correct?
I agree. And quite frankly, I do think it might be difficult to draw a specific line about, you know, could this have been, you know, closer to the statutory mechanism? You know, what would that necessarily look like as opposed to this informal agent reaching out to the judge? I mean, I get that there's probably a lot of room in between the two. And I also understand that it's difficult to draw that specific line of what is too much, what goes too far to administer or to where it basically intrudes on that line of administering supervision. But I, that being said, I given the Court of Appeals interpretation and how the statutes work, I don't see that what was ordered here, or at least the condition as interpreted by the Court of Appeals, that that does anything but require the parties to comply with the state statute.
Okay, so this is why I'm concerned. You didn't argue this, and I'm really concerned about the informal process. And the reason I'm very concerned about the informal process is because it cuts everyone out of what's going on, including the victim, right? And you and I both know that victims have a constitutional right upon request to be heard in any proceeding during which a right of the victim is implicated, including release, plea, sentencing, disposition, parole, revocation, expungement, or pardon. I cannot think of a situation that would implicate a victim's rights more than deciding whether or not the victim or is allowed to live with the defendant, or the defendant is allowed to live with the victim or the victim's child. And so I'm really concerned about this informal process. And see, the formal process is the only way to ensure that we would comply with the constitutional rights of victims in these cases. I'm just wondering how you see it.
Justice Karofsky, I 100% agree. I don't see that there really is a way to have this informal process, because it does cut out the various players, as you've indicated. And I, you know, whether it's even the victims, the state, what have you, I mean, I can see there being situations where this very much proves problematic if we don't actually have an opportunity for the parties to be heard and before the circuit court actually makes its decision. So, again, I'm not here to defend this informal practice of having email correspondence with DOC agents and having the decisions made that way. It's really unworkable, and if quite frankly, if the circuit court, if that's the only way the circuit court intends to try to do that, again, I'm not here to defend that.
So can you help me with the actual, because I think listening to you, listening to some of the questions, I mean, I think this, the formal process is something that at least everyone acknowledges. What I'm having a hard time with is if we were to leave this as it is, if we were to affirm the condition that essentially was, affirm the Court of Appeals who affirmed the condition and read it however they read it, if you look at the condition itself, the condition that was imposed was that the defendant not reside with any member of the opposite sex without the permission of the court, and also the same thing for a child. But so that's the condition. So what exactly is the modification? I mean, if you think about modifying that condition, that's not really what the defendant would be doing. A modification is more like you're ordered one thing, you come in and you ask for another. We would have to read out the words without permission of the court. Because that, otherwise, there's nothing to be modified. Do you see what I'm asking?
No,
what are they modifying without the permission of the court? Okay. What's being modified?
I understand. And I guess, you know, I personally can't get into the circuit court's mind. And I know that there was a dispute between the parties regarding how this modification would actually play out. So would this be a matter of he is now allowed to live with women and unrelated children, or would it play out to he's allowed to live with Jane and Mary or Susan, but no other individuals? I mean, I know the Court of Appeals read into this a little bit more and suggested that it might be a particular woman or a particular child, but I get that that's not what the circuit court had ordered. And as far as a modification goes, it seems that if he has established that he could reside with women and children, for example, I guess I don't know how the modification would be anything other than basically removing the condition.
Right. He could go into court and say, I want to remove the condition unless or without permission of the court. That would be a modification.
Correct.
But so we're stuck with reading this out somehow. I mean, it doesn't, going back to Justice Hagedorn's point, does it make more sense to remand to let the circuit court may have been clear, but I guess with our instructions about what it can and cannot do, let the circuit court decide what the condition actually is that can then be brought in with a formal hearing to be modified.
If the court is inclined to do so, I understand that the given the point that we've now reached where there has been some, you know, interpretations made of what the court actually intended here, some being did the court intend this informal process, others did the court maybe intend to have this being done more formally. If the court is inclined to remand for purposes of the circuit court to make that clear, I understand that, I guess. My opposition to a remand, quite frankly, came from the fact that if he is seeking some type of modification, and I don't know if he intends to do so right away, but if he is seeking some type of modification, he can make that request, and then the court can revisit it at that time, rather than remanding it right now to decide hypothetically, you know, what might be done in the future. And I just think that it makes sense to simply leave the condition as ordered by the, or as clarified by the Court of Appeals, and if he seeks a modification at that point, then it can be addressed.
That's problematic.
It's problematic, the word?
That's problematic. That's right. We got trouble right here in River City. you said in your argument today, it's tough to see what the court did. You later said, I can't get into the court's mind. You also said, I concede that, and then I forgot I couldn't catch up with you, but I took it to mean you concede that it's unclear what the court had in its mind. Those are my words, not yours. The others are all your words. So since you've pretty much acknowledged it's not clear if what the court of how the Court of Appeals interpreted the order was really what the circuit court intended, why wouldn't we send it back? Remanded to let the circuit court weigh in as to what it meant. Maybe the Court of Appeals got it wrong in its interpretation. I don't know. And you don't know either.
That's correct. I think the issue here is that right now we have this condition that directs him not to live with any women and children. And I think regardless of, well, I mean, ultimately if this court's affirms, we are left with an individual that if he wants to live with women and children, he is going to have to seek, however you want to call it, permission from the court, okay? If he files something that's, I don't know, not necessarily, doesn't really comport with statute or something like that, if the court revisits it for that reason or requires him to file something, I mean, I think that that's something that can be addressed when he's actually seeking some type of modification. I don't necessarily think that it's something that needs to be done right now, but again, certainly if the court thinks that an immediate clarification from the circuit court is warranted, I'm not here to oppose that.
Why can't we clarify it ourselves and say that we construe the order as requiring a formal process with the court, period?
I think you could do that, and I think if there is a problem, and I know it's been hinted at in the reply brief or even in the initial brief that Mr. Williams Holmes might want to now challenge the condition on its face about require or potentially limiting his ability to live with women and children. You know, there are opportunities for him to challenge this. And I think that if this court's order simply affirms it as interpreted by the Court of Appeals, I don't really see why there'd be a reason to remand immediately other than to just allow him an opportunity to make a request.
Well, he can make whatever motion he wants to when it leaves this court. I mean, if he thinks the conditions are unfair or unnecessary or whatever argument he makes, I guess I'm more concerned about our saying what we can say. And it seems to me that you, as you said, you're not defending an informal process because it does cut out the rights of victims who would be present if the formal process were used. So I don't know why we can't direct the manner in which the condition is to be exercised by the court.
I don't think there's any problem with that either. And certainly if the court, I mean, the court has the authority to modify conditions, as is central to the issue in this case, and for whatever reason, the circuit court disagrees with how this court is interpreted or it missed the point somewhere along the lines, the circuit court can certainly make its modifications at that point without an unnecessary remand, that is. So really, I mean, the bottom line here, the parties really aren't that far apart in their arguments. I mean, we agree that the statutes provide the circuit court with the authority to place defendants on probation and conditions. We agree that the statutes allow DOC or vest DOC with the authority to actually supervise those on supervision, administer those conditions. And I think it's telling, and I believe Justice Kurofsky pointed this out, Mr. Williams-Holmes doesn't really argue that this blanket prohibition is problematic. Really, it's about, and it's been clarified here even more so in oral argument, that the only problem with this is that the judge anticipates that there could be a modification down the road. Not even orders that there will be, but basically just gives that defendant an incentive to take probation or extended supervision seriously, comply with their conditions, do these various things, and there's light at the end of the tunnel. There could be a modification at that point. And I don't see any authority that stands for that premise that is somehow problematic. It's certainly not found in the statutes. There's no definition of administering that I'm aware of that suggests that if a court even has an inkling in its mind that it may modify a condition at some later time or even tell someone, hey, if you work on your sobriety and you're able to do these things, then you can visit a bar or tavern for dinner sometime down the road, or you can leave this particular, I don't know, leave this state or something along those lines. I don't see how that willingness, that being upfront and honesty with the defendant, rises to the level of improperly administering supervision. It's certainly not in the statute, nor is it really supported by any of the case law that's been offered. In Sepulveda, this court was very clear about circuit court's continued power to effectuate that probationary program, and to do so by modifying conditions of probation and extended supervision. And in Lintz, the Court of Appeals recognized even after the point where control had shifted from the court sentencing to the Department of Corrections, that the court still maintained authority to modify conditions or to modify department rules to basically ensure that its probationary program was protected, even when there's a conflict between them. That honestly makes sense. The last thing we want is a court to be rendered powerless to effectuate its goals at sentencing as soon as the offender walks out of the courtroom. None of the authority that's been cited, which should lead this court to arrive at the conclusion that a circuit court's authority needs to be curbed more than it is. Horn and Birchfield were two cases that were referenced. We're not here to dispute that the Department of Corrections is tasked with revoking probation. I mean, certainly that's not what we're here to argue. And I mean, to the extent that it's being offered for the proposition that there are certain roles that are DOC's responsibility and certain that are the court's, again, I'm not here to dispute that. Mr. William Holmes also provides, Shell, but the case, at least I believe I'm pronouncing it correctly. I mean, really all that reinforced is that a court can't use its statutory power to modify conditions in such a way that intrude upon DOC's authority. In that case, it was dictating how a jail sentence is going to be served, whether it would be served on electronic monitoring or under home arrest versus in the county jail. But in this case, DOC doesn't have some type of statutory or inherent authority to decide whether Mr. Williams Holmes lives with women or children.
Counsel, two things tangentially bother me about this case. You cited a case or two just now, but of course uncited, and certainly I understand why, are the two unpublished Court of Appeals regarding the same judge, it appears the same activity, and even at least one of the members of the Court of Appeals sat on all three of these. Yet the two unpublished cases conclude that the circuit court lacked authority to require McNair to return to it rather than the Department of Corrections when seeking permission to reside with children. The legislature has tasked the Department of Corrections, not the courts, with supervising offenders, citing the statute. So, what do you make of that? What should I make of that? The very same judge, the very same activity, you know, I mean, is it the third time is the charm, and now we've got the answer? Actually, the third time is published, and so I suppose now we have the answer.
Justice Bradley, I can only say that's the reason why this court granted review, is to actually weigh in on that and decide, because there is some question about whether this condition is lawful and whether the same circuit court judge who has ordered this condition in the past, whether he could or could not do it. What I'm saying is that I think that the case law, the statutes, everything is on the side of what the Court of Appeals interpreted here in deciding that as long as it's being done through the statutory mechanisms that the legislature's enacted allow courts to do this, there isn't a problem with this being or running afoul of administering probation in violation of the statutes that allow DOC to do so.
The second thing that bothers me a bit is I noticed that when your opposing counsel first was responding to questions, his responses were a bit nuanced, as well as responses should be, but particularly nuanced with regard to whether or not this condition is okay if it didn't have, without permission of the court, that phrase. And I note on page 22 of the brief, his brief, that he preserves the right to challenge this condition without arguing it here, a condition prohibiting him from living with all women and unrelated children may be subject to an overbreath challenge for violating the First Amendment right to association. Look, that issue is not before us. That what was written was clearly indicating he's not making that argument. It's not before us. And yet, I'm concerned that what do we do with that potential whiff, that potential, you know, maybe that's more for us to decide as a court, but what do you think? How should we handle that when we write this opinion, although not addressing the issue? It's not raised. How can you address it, right? but what do you do with that comment?
I think it, to some extent, for the court to really assess that, it would be to somewhat jump the gun. And I say that because if there is a motion filed after the fact to modify these conditions or to challenge the overbreadth or the constitutionality of this condition, you know, that's not before the court, but you know, certainly there would have to be the question of whether, basically, why is that argument not being raised initially, instead of waiting until we go through a full round of review up to the Supreme Court to then raise it down the road. You know, if the circuit court decides that there's a sufficient reason to overlook why it wasn't raised, I mean, certainly the court can address it then. I just don't know if there's really a need for this court to decide at this point, at least.
Yes, I totally agree with you on that. I'm just, you know, I'm just wondering if we should pause with our embrace of whatever we are going to embrace because of this. Okay, thank you.
Yes. So, just to wrap up a bit, you know, as I was commenting, the Department of Corrections really doesn't have some statutory or inherent authority to decide whether Mr. Williams Holmes lives with women or children. It's going to enforce the conditions that the court has imposed. And that is really to not live with women and children unless the court is ultimately going to modify that. And quite frankly, you know, when we look through all the authority that's cited in these briefs, I'm unaware of any authority that supports the premise that if the court anticipates that someday later that it will modify a condition of probation or extended supervision, that runs afoul of any statutes basically vesting DOC with the authority to administer supervision. So ultimately, Your Honors, this court was very clear in Sepulveda that the circuit courts maintain that continued power to effectuate its goals, and the legislature has enacted statutes that allow them to very easily exercise that. The Court of Appeals recognized the same, and I'd ask that you not abandon Sepulveda or any other authority for that matter, and reaffirm that the circuit courts, or that the circuit court here, soundly exercised its discretion and ordered a condition that comports with state statute and published case law. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Bell?
Thank you. I want to return, I think, briefly to a case that was discussed by my opponent on the other side here. State versus Shell, I think, addresses a lot of the concerns that were discussed in my initial argument about the court's ability to use the modification power to kind of make that end run around the administration of supervision being a DOC authority. You know, in Shell, again, the judge is trying to, you know, modify its condition essentially to require that the defendant serve that 100 days of condition time in the county jail. And the Court of Appeals concludes that that's a problem, that the court is attempting to step outside of its statutory lane. And I think that that's what we have here similarly, is the judge at the time of sentencing here trying to, again, keep its hands on the defendant in a way that it really should be turned over to the Department of Corrections to figure out, again, these more particular determinations about which women and children the defendant lives with. And I think that's the problem with the condition as created by the court here, is that the judge is not, as I think the state has sort of suggested at times, imposed a condition where the defendant is going to return one time and be given blanket permission to remove the condition and live with any women or children.
But wasn't the issue in Shell between the judge and the sheriff? Because the sheriff, right, the judge orders condition time, and the sheriff says, I'm going to place you call it an EMP, electronic monitoring, or house, whatever. You know what I'm talking about, house arrest, whatever. In reading Shell, I didn't see the rub being between the judge and the Department of Corrections. I thought it was between the judge and the sheriff.
The judge and the sheriff, sure, but I think that it's a distinction without a particularly meaningful difference in that there the sheriff has the statutory authority to figure out how a defendant is going to serve some, you know, term of any term of imprisonment, whereas here it's the Department of Corrections that will determine.
And a sheriff has constitutional authority.
Well, it doesn't. Right, and doesn't it matter that there are specific statutes for DOC? I'm just not seeing them maybe as interchangeable as you are, because there are specific statutes allowing for the modification of probation through DOC, which are all those 303s, right? And I think it's.
Sure.
I'm not sure it's exactly the same. I understand the point you're making. I'm not sure it's exactly that simple.
Well, I think that I acknowledge that the statute at issue in Shell is somewhat more specific in authorizing the sheriff to figure out how a defendant is going to serve a term of imprisonment. Because here, it is a broader, you know, granting of authority to the Department of Corrections to administer a term of supervision. So it's not that there's a statute that says in so much detail department will select which women and children a defendant will live with. It's that broader grant of authority. And I think that the constitutional issues are, I think, similar or comparable in that the Department of Corrections, you know, is also, as a part of the executive branch, a constitutional actor here. And there's an expectation, I think, that these various institutional actors will respect their various boundaries.
The Department of Corrections' constitutional actor status and the constitutional authority of a sheriff are quite different. Don't you agree?
I suppose the executive branch itself is, the constitutional actor here. This court in Horn has, identified the constitutional shift of, you know, the balance of power, or not the balance of power to the Department of Corrections after a sentence is imposed, at which point, you know, the judicial role ends, and it should be, you know, the role of the executive branch through the Department of Corrections to effectuate the term.
I think the constitutional authority of a sheriff is different, just so you know.
Sure. And I don't think that it, you know, plays any particularly important role here, again, because, you know, Shell is discussing that statutory, you know, provision of authority to determine where the imprisonment is served. I think that there was some discussion previously about, you know, the need for remand. And, again, do encourage that that seems the proper course if the court is contemplating accepting the court's condition, but with the understanding that it only allow permission through the modification process, only because, you know, the circuit court, again, has not had that opportunity to weigh in on the condition as modified by the Court of Appeals or potentially by this court. And I think that it is unclear exactly what the circuit court would have to say about it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for good oral argument. Thank you for joining us on this iffy weather day and finding a way to get here. The court is adjourned until our next oral argument, which should be in a matter of minutes, I think. All right. Have a good day. Be safe.